Tuesday, May 11th, meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to order. And members, we have a lot to accomplish this morning, so we're going to plunge right in. And I will open a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3555. Mr. Stembridge.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3555 directs the State Commission on Children and Families to establish a shaken baby syndrome prevention program. It requires hospitals and birthing centers to offer the program by July 2nd, 2008. It makes parent participation in the program voluntary. It requires the Commission to report on the levels of program participation in the Legislative Assembly by February 1st of each pod numbered year.
And thank you for that explanation. Representative Gelster is here. Would you like to come forward? Did you have anybody you wanted to bring up with you?
I do. One of our witnesses is on her way back from Shanghai.
She's on her way.
All right. We've got a neurosurgeon and Dr. Lace.
Great.
Also, and Monica can just join me when she comes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Representative Sarah Gelser. I represent House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath and Denton County, and I also represent two individuals who live in Linn County. Neither of them voted for me. Okay. So here I am. I come to you today with a recommendation for change in the bill that is before you. We have met with all of the stakeholders actually between 8 o'clock and 8:30 this morning and have come up with a solution that is mutually agreeable to the Oregon Medical Association, the Oregon Pediatric Society, and the Oregon Hospital Association. This bill, as it's written right now, would require the establishment of a mandatory hospital-based statewide shaken baby syndrome prevention program. There are 16 other states currently that have such mandatory legislation. Four other states, not including Oregon, are currently considering such legislation. The impetus behind this program that states are implementing is that in the hospital, after a baby is born, they offer families the opportunity to watch a video about shaken baby syndrome, the damage that it can cause to children, and other more appropriate ways of dealing with a crying infant than shaking. For those of you that have had babies in your home, you probably can think back to the times when you sat up at nighttime crying right along with your baby, because the crying went on for a very long period of time. And that's a very real thing for many, many families. And this isn't a lot of bad people that are going around and shaking their babies. It is a lack of understanding of how to cope and how to find appropriate ways to deal with that. There were some concerns from the Hospital Association that this was coming very fast. It was a priority bill. The idea was brought to me while we were working on another child abuse investigation bill that we all voted off of the House floor a couple of weeks ago, Carly's Law. And the intent really is to have buy-in. There's nobody that wants to have shaken babies, and everybody wants to participate in reducing them. And so what we would like to do, I'd like Dr. Lace and Dr. Webby to talk with you a little bit about why it would be necessary to have legislation to do this. But I'm proposing bringing back to you, if you would be willing to schedule a work session maybe next Wednesday, an amendment that would cause a work group to come together to develop a voluntary statewide shaken baby prevention program, and that group would report back in October of 2008 about how widely distributed that was, so that if it's not successful in getting this education to every child across the state in a voluntary way, we can look at that in a mandatory way in 2009. It would also give this group the opportunity to pursue the $10 million that the federal government has just made available for these programs to look at possible sources of funding, and the Hospital Association has indicated that they are willing to staff this interim work group. And I really would like to recognize Jane Ellen Wydance, who's really worked hard on this the last couple of weeks in terms of trying to find a way to bring everybody together. And with that, I'd like to introduce the two wonderful doctors who are on either side of me. Dr. Webby is a neurosurgeon from Legacy Emanuel Hospital, a very good one, from personal experience, I might add, and Dr. Lace, who you all know very well. You go first. You get
all right. I'm Jim Lace, for the record, and I represent the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm a pediatrician here in Salem, and I've been practicing pediatrics for 30 years. We think that prevention is the keystone to preventing shaken baby syndrome. Shaken baby syndrome literally is when parents can either take a small child shake them like this because the child is crying. Sometimes they hit them. Sometimes they hit them against things. And what that causes is that there's an acceleration of the head and then a rapid deacceleration. And the blood vessels, the structures in the developing child are not as like in adults. And they tear very easily. Subsequently, you get blood produced inside the brain and or on top of the brain and around the brain, causes compression. You end up with loss of function. When I first started pediatrics, 30-some years ago, my very first kid that I had when I was at Cincinnati General Hospital was a shaken baby. And that mother ended up, you know, raising that child. I had an opportunity over those 3 years to follow that mother and that child. And, you know, she had to deal with the consequences of the brain damage that she caused the child. And she told me what she did. There was no question about that. We just recently had one of our own patients just die. Who was a child that was in this situation, subsequently died after much state money was spent maintaining that child and after the initial brain damage had occurred. Other states, other places that have done this have done what you would call a poster child sort of an approach to life. The first state was New York City, and George Lithgow, who's an attorney general in that state, his own child was killed by a 51-year-old, should have been just fine, you know, caretaker, and that was the case that came out and produced their law in New York. We would like to prevent that in Oregon. We have enough of our own individual cases, but that haven't risen up to the level of, gosh, here's this very famous person, a lawyer or a doctor or whatever, and somebody that says, oh, my gosh, we've got to do something about that. We'd like to prevent that and make it into a program that we can promote and parents can use. This is, as you noted, a voluntary program. We have vitamin K administration to all newborns in the state. A parent can opt out if they want, but they're told about the consequences if they opt out. Newborn eye prophylaxis, the same idea. Newborn hearing screening, which you all passed here not too long ago. Those are all things that are done routinely. Parents do have the option of opting out. Same thing with this program. It's not that they have to watch this video. It's not that they have to take the instruction program, but we want them to do that. And if we can reduce, based on other studies in other states, the incidence of shaken baby by 50%, that's huge. If you look in my written testimony, 18 babies, 2005, 16 of them were less than 5. That would mean we could chop that down to 8. 8 is still a huge number. It's way too many kids dying of a prevention or a preventable problem like child abuse. However, you know, we take strides and hopefully we'll move things forward. And as Representative Gelser noted, these are not necessarily evil people or bad people. Many of them just don't understand the dynamics of how easy the brain is damaged and how easy these children are injured. And the idea is that when they shake them enough, they quiet down. Well, they start quieting down because of the injury to the brain. And that's why they stop crying at that time. So I would urge you to look at this. I think the things that we've worked out here at the last minute, we apologize coming so late in the session, but things happen, as you know. And I think that this has the opportunity with everybody on board to do this. To give you an idea, in New York, they estimate that it costs $6 for the materials. So that would be something that, you know, we could be looking at for grant money. The hospitals would participate in terms of having dedicated nurses doing the actual teaching of that within the hospital setting so that the parents have that and they take these videos home with them too so they can replay those if they want. And what the video does is basically gives them an idea about recognizing the stress, what you can do so you don't have to resort to hitting your child or shaking your baby. The comments that have come back based on what people have responded to say the video is the most important part because it's all visual, audiovisual. It's not just somebody lecturing blah, blah, blah like I'm doing right now. So you can actually see that. You can actually see firsthand. Oh, I could, and then they remember that at 2 o'clock in the morning when it's their own baby that's, you know, causing the stress. So I think I'll stop there, answer questions, and we'll let Dr. Wiebe go on.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we'll hear from the whole panel, and then open it up for questions. Okay. And please go ahead.
I've got a few scans kind of to show.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
I'm Monica Webby, a pediatric neurosurgeon with Microneurosurgical Consultants, and I work at primarily at Emmanuel Children's Hospital. It's the biggest children's hospital in the state. We see a lot of shaken babies, and being the only pediatric neurosurgeon there, they usually come through me. And I was talking with Lila Keltner, our CARES coordinator. We see probably about two a month of these babies that have head injury at Emmanuel Children's. And I also cover St. Vincent's Pediatric Hospital. So I have a couple of scans. These are obvious enough that you can kind of hold up to the light and see, because we don't have a view box. We kind of found out about this a couple days ago and didn't have time to get a view box and everything for you. But you can see what's going on. I'm going to just give you two examples of what really happens to these babies when this occurs. And the first one, I'm going to give you these two, and I'll let you pass them as we go, as soon as I tell you to go. The one on top is the early, the next one is the falling. So this first little girl is a three-month-old triplet, and the parents were young. You know, she was born at 35 weeks gestation, and this is her original scan that I saw when she came into the hospital. So you can get a look at it, get an idea of what a brain looks like in there, and the fluid is up towards the front. So this little baby was born at 35 weeks gestation, which was good for triplets. You know, they made it to 35 weeks, and this baby was the biggest of the babies. And they were in the NICU for a month and at a different outside hospital. Then they went home for a couple months. And then about 20 days before admission, the baby came in at 3 months of age, or 2 months corrected. About 20 days before admission, she started to have some nausea and vomiting. And the mom went off with some of her sisters and went shopping, grocery shopping, and left dad with the triplets. And then shortly thereafter, this little triplet ended up in the emergency room, not breathing, and her heart rate was very low, and she was very cold, and the story that we hear is always the same, that they fed the baby, they put her down, and she stopped breathing. It's the same story we get every time on these babies. I, to be honest with you, don't even ask the story anymore. I just see the scan and see the baby and take the baby to the OR. But so anyway, this little girl, you can see the fluid in the front, the area that's in front of the brain there. So when we see that, the baby comes in. The baby's usually unresponsive. They've usually been intubated and transferred to our hospital. The little soft spot's really tense. It'll feel like a soccer ball in these babies. You know, it should be nice and sunken like a little ashtray. And when they get under pressure, it gets really full and tense. And it's just the baby's head's a bunch of individual little bones, and it just stretches out. So what happens is you go and you drain this fluid, and then you try to ride her through the problem. And the problem, you guys, now you're passing what her brain ended up looking like at the end, which is a big head full of water. When you shake a baby, there are different areas of the brain. It's kind of like Jell-O salad. You know, if you got Jell-O salad with the grapes in there, you know, it's different density. And when you shake it, it breaks at that different density point. So you've got the lighter stuff and heavier stuff. So it breaks and it tears all the little axons, because your brain develops radially, like, you know, the rays of the sun coming out. And so if you shake, you start breaking all those axons, and then that causes swelling. So when you do that, you get a lot of swelling in the brain. And in addition, you get bleeding on the surface because you tear veins. But the main issue is that you're shaking everything and tearing up all the cells in the brain. Causes all this swelling. Baby goes under, brain gets under pressure. When your brain's under pressure, when the pressure in the head gets higher than the blood pumping, you don't get any blood, and you have a massive stroke like this little baby, and her head's just a bunch of water now, because the entire brain melts away over a period of a month or so. It's amazing. But that's what happens with her. And also, when you shake a baby, the pivot point, unfortunately, is the brainstem. You know, a baby's head's much heavier than the body, so it'll just waddle back and forth. And you're yanking on the brainstem. And when you yank on the brainstem, they become apneic. They can't breathe. And then they pass out for a little while, and they stop crying. You know, they're stunned. And so it seems to work. You know, if you're the person shaking the baby, if you
shake them, they stop crying, so it seems to work. There's no bruises, there's no marks, you know, baby must be okay. You know, and so this is what happens. This little girl had been shaken before, which is why she had all that fluid in the front of the brain, so that she had been shaken 20 days earlier when she started throwing up and was sick. Okay, and then so her brain was already injured, so a second event was enough to just totally knock her over the edge, and she couldn't compensate. And there's degrees of shaking, but so anyway, that's what happened with that little girl. So she ended up dying finally at about 3 years of age because her brain stem still worked. You know, her heart beat, she was able to breathe, she had a G-tube, and she hung around for about 3 years with no higher cortical function at all, but was still alive because her brain stem still worked. And so that was what happened with her. Just another quick example, this little guy wasn't as bad, but it's a matter of how you look at it. Because he actually still has a little bit of function. Same story, six-month-old little boy, you know, mom went to work, and I think this, I can't remember if this was a boyfriend or a father, but it was the same story, and the baby wouldn't stop crying and got shaken, and that's the original scan where he comes in, and you can see that kind of patchy area, the little kind of dark patchy areas, that's his original scan, and you're already seeing strokes develop. Strokes are those little dark areas, and then you can see on his next scan, the way the brain just melts away. You know, as you see, it's really impressive. It just melts away because it's dead. It's a stroke. So this little guy now, at three, last time I saw him was when he was three, and he was able to roll over and could say mom and hi, and had a G-tube, and that was really all he could do. That was as far as he got with development. And so the problem is that it's always the same thing. It's always, you know, it's usually, the parents are usually relatively young. They're tired, they've been working all night or whatever, and they're frustrated, and they find out that if they shake the baby just a little bit, it'll stop crying. And so some people do it as a routine, you know, procedure. Other people just finally get really frustrated, and they don't realize how hard they're shaking. They don't realize what they're doing. You know, when you're really mad and tired, you don't, your adrenaline's going, you just want the kid to shut up, you know, and they'll shake, and it happens, and they're not bad people. They're just tired, and they figure it's better to get the baby quiet. They don't want to walk off and leave the baby, which is what they should do, just lay the baby down and walk away. And I think if they understood this, that things would be better. We do see, you know, Jim was saying, what, 18 kids were killed this past year. But there's a lot more that are just, you know, damaged or severely delayed. I see a lot of kids that are hemiplegic or have severe learning disabilities now. And it's a shame because these were normal kids. A lot of these are ex-preemies that we've already spent, you know, billions of dollars trying to keep alive. And then they go home and the parents are frustrated. And so the problem with this is that it's so preventable. And if we could just help these people realize that it's better to just lay the baby down and walk away, call and get help, get your mama there, somebody to help you out, as opposed to just getting frustrated and aggravated and shaking these little guys. And it's terrible for the babies. It's terrible, but it's terrible for the shaker. Because I have to, every time I see these babies come in, I hate it because I know that I'm going to have to go to court, I'm going to have to testify every time, you know, because they always have to go to trial unless they settle, and some of the guys are perpetrators, a lot of them will confess, but because they're so devastated by it, and they'll tell you, you know, they got tears in their eyes, they're telling you about this, oh, I was just, you know, I didn't know, I hurt him, I didn't mean to do it, I, you know, and you see them as you're going through all this, and I feel bad having to send them away, you know, for these things, and it's just heartbreaking to their family and the baby, you know, it's terrible. So I think that the bill is excellent. I'm so proud of Sarah for bringing it forward, because we could really help these people just learning to just step back and walk away, which is really hard to do. I've got four kids. I know I've felt like throwing them out the window before, too. I mean, you get that way. You're tired. And if you just learn these coping skills, you just got to step back. And I'm an old lady. I can't imagine young, you know, 18, 17-year-old parents trying to deal with these stresses. So
thank you for considering the bill, and I hope that we can, we're all happy and on the same page, and we all would like for it to go.
And everybody is supportive of the amendments that Representative Gelster talked about. So thank you very much for your testimony, and are there questions?
Yes, no Mr. question. Just a comment. This is, you know, images, doctor, that the rest of us don't see, and they're disturbing and emotionally sort of exhausting. Mm-hmm. But I will say I like where you're going with this bill. I serve on the foundation for the Sentinel Hospital, and this is the kind of thing that, as a foundation, we are looking for these kinds of programs, and there are other funders out there that, you know, as far as state money, in some way, where I want to put as many dollars as I can is into things like relief nurseries, where you have a program that targets this population in a proactive way. But as a member of the Sentinel Hospital Foundation, this is the kind of thing where if you can get this information to these critical people at the critical time, and we do, by the way, at the Sentinel Hospital, fund videos for new parents. You know we do, Dr. Lace. So this is, I love where you're going with this. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My wife serves as the director of the Children's Center at Clackamas County, the Child Abuse and the Cares Northwest of Clackamas County. And fortunately, she doesn't bring the slide homes. I just get to hear the story. It's even more devastating to see these slides. And unfortunately, by the time they get to places like the Children's Center, it's too late. You're then left with really two bad sets of options.
Right.
And so I just applaud all your efforts to get ahead of these and prevent them.
The X-rays, the CT scans, the MRIs are... Dr. Lace again. Those are all cleaned up. I mean, they're not cleaned up. I mean, those are the real deal, but they're so abstract. To look at what she sees when she has to go in there is completely different. And you want to look at horrifying things. You want to look at pictures. It's like, oh, my gosh. It's hard to imagine, you know, what is actually going on inside. So just take that and magnify that 100 times over and actually have to deal with those kids on a regular basis, too, afterwards, you know, which is the other place. I didn't really go into money savings and all these other issues, how much the state spends on these children. So we think it's a great idea to prevent them. Save that money, spend it elsewhere.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, and thanks for being here.
I do believe that Danielle is here from.
And Representative, we will take a look at our schedule. If you will let us know when the amendments are ready, we will work it back in. I'm sure you can do that. We have a couple of other witnesses, and I will call Jane Ellen Whitehance. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, my name is Jane Ellen Whitehance, and I'm the Director of Public Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And thank you for allowing me to testify today on behalf of the 57 hospitals and health systems throughout the state of Oregon. And I could see from the back those scans that you were looking at, and I'm kind of choked up about it in the stories, because we understand as hospitals, and I as a dedicated advocate, understand that we have a critical role to play here. We really appreciate Representative Gelser's willingness to amend the bill and move towards a voluntary program. We believe this will give us the opportunity to both develop statewide standards and statewide ideas of how to implement this, but then allow local communities to come together and develop programs that make sense. Because it's not just what the hospitals can do. It's also the relief nurseries and other programs that you mentioned that can support families when they're in crisis and in having trouble. So we do support the conceptual amendments that Representative Gelser spoke about, and we really admire everyone who has brought this forward because we know that they are very dedicated to children, and Oregon's hospitals are dedicated to preventing child abuse and damage to children, and we want children to be healthy and safe. And just one statistic is that 66% of the hospitals that we surveyed in the last 2 days responded very quickly. 66% of them actually are doing stuff on shaken baby syndromes, and if we can improve that and work together to bring that up even higher and make it a statewide focus, we would love to do that. So thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Okay. Thanks very much for being here. And I will call Dr. Malcone. And Dr. Cohen, I don't know if you were here when, well, I know you weren't here when Representative Gelster testified that there are amendments on the way, so you are familiar with those too.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohen. I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services in the Public Health Division. Yes, I spoke with the group that testified and with Representative Gelster earlier this morning, and I'm fully supportive of the amendments. I am trained as a pediatrician, so I've seen these cases, you know, as a doctor. But as a public health professional, this is also a very, very important issue for us. One of the things that I do as the state epidemiologist is I sit on the co-chair, actually, together with Dr. Karin Gunson, our state medical examiner, of our state child fatality review team. And I can tell you that what we do is hear about all of the unexpected child deaths that occur in the state. And my reaction in those meetings is very similar to what Representative Hunt and Representative Berger expressed. Every one of these stories is heartbreaking, and I leave that meeting so angry because each of them is really a failure of what we've done collectively to try to prevent these deaths, and very committed to try to do something about it. So I'm very pleased that this issue is being acted upon, and I really commend Representative Gelser for taking some leadership around this. In my office, as a result of the work of the Child Fatality Review Team, one of the questions that was raised was, well, we know how many kids die from this, but what about kids who don't die? Because, of course, you can be injured even quite severely and survive. And this can sometimes be a difficult diagnosis to recognize because often the children don't have any external signs of the trauma that they've suffered. So we embarked on a study together with our partners in the community, some of whom are here today, and tried to get a handle on how many of these non-fatal cases of shaken baby syndrome there were. We looked from 2000 to 2004, so that's a five-year period, and we found 61 probable cases of shaken baby syndrome in the state. And these folks, they're terrible human tragedies and cost millions of dollars in care for these kids as they live. Of course, this, because of the undercounting problem, this is probably an underestimate, and we expect there are quite a few more than that as well. So this is a very important public health problem for us. Representative Gelser asked if public health would be interested in getting involved in this work, and I was really pleased that she did that because I think that we bring a lot to the table, not only the information about data and statistics that we can add, but also our connections with the whole system of care for children. And many of you have alluded to trying to link up this work with prenatal care providers, with folks who are providing parenting education, and so forth. We do a lot of work with those folks already, so we have those relationships built. And, of course, also as part of the Department of Human Services, we have relationships with the folks who do child protection as well. And I think those people all are very interested in this work and will be important partners to bring to the table. So I'm very pleased with this. I'm very excited about the amendments. I think it will give us the time to think through how to implement this very carefully and thoughtfully and pull everybody on board. So I'm very excited about this. Thank you for hearing the bill, and I'll be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the probables that you talked about, the 60-some. You know, those obviously were children that were substantially injured by the shake and bake. We really don't have an idea of how many people may have learning disabilities and other kinds of things caused from a single occasion and some others, and there could be thousands of those. I mean, as a school employee and watching things happen, you know, we have come to understand the ramifications, at least at the high school level where I was, for kids that were alcohol syndrome and some of the other drug-affected kinds of things. But there are a number of kids who fall out of those characteristics, and you see them at high school, and they're still having a difficult time functioning in certain areas. And from a testimony that we heard today, and looking at those pictures, it's clear to me that if there were a stroke, and most of these kids are never going to have a brain scan. I mean, they're going to go through life. They're not going to have that. So would you agree with me, I guess, that there could be the 68 seems very small to me in comparison to what I believe is probably happening out there.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, I think that's right on target. The way that we did this study was we looked at all of the kids who were admitted to a hospital and had some kind of diagnosis of severe brain trauma, and then went back and looked. So if a child wasn't injured enough to actually land in a hospital and carry one of those diagnoses, would not have been picked up. We do know that traumatic brain injury, not only from shaken baby, but from a variety of insults, we know it's very common, and we know it has these long-term effects on people's ability to regulate emotion, on their cognitive abilities, and so forth. And you're absolutely right. This is a huge burden for our educational system and our social service system because these folks are not functioning to their full potential because of the injuries they've received. Absolutely.
Yes, follow up.
And on top of that, I think it is also a real burden on lots of families. There are many families out there who take responsibility for the kids having these problems. They think it may be genetic. I mean, no one's ever told them. We have mothers that are thinking it. We got all these different kinds of wondering, why is my child having so much trouble in school or having these other kinds of problems? And if, you know, when this bill passes and when we start seeing less of this happening because of education, maybe we'll see that change take place, that it won't relieve them of that, because in fact they will find out they maybe were more directly responsible for what happened later on in their children's lives. But at least they'll have some answers, and I think that's important for some of these kids and families. So thanks.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, I wanted to mention there is another bill on the Senate side related to traumatic brain injury that is wending its way through, and hopefully you all will see at some point in the next few weeks, that tries to create a registry of folks who have experienced brain injury, and as a way to provide education about services that are available and some support for some of these folks. And speak to some of that.
One more comment.
Go ahead.
You know, having grown up as this dyslexic kid that I am, and recognizing that all the people don't see the world, and therefore there is an issue in wiring. What is so difficult for most of these kids, and when the things that would be helpful, is that most people don't recognize it because they can't see a problem. And without a visual impairment, it's difficult for people to realize how difficult that person is dealing with the world that is different from the world of other people. So I commend the people who are doing this, and I hope that people, as we go on, and I commend all of the neurosurgery things, because there's a lot better idea of how the brain functions today. The pictures that have been taken that indicate why things are the way they are pretty impressive these days. So that was just a comment, so thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Cohn, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3555? Okay, well, this is obviously an extremely important bill, and we will look forward to the amendments and to working with you, Representative Gelster, so thank you for bringing this to us. I'll close the public hearing and work session on House Bill 3555. I think we'll go through the other bills so that we can leave, hopefully, the last half hour for our rule change. We do have floor session at 10. I'll open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 967A. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 967A abolishes the Joint Legislative Committees on Water Policy, Transportation, Trade and Economic Development, Land Use, and the Oregon Plan, and it repeals the related statutes. Madam Chair, I've noted an error in the staff measure summary that you have. As far as the Trade and Economic Development Committee, which I have some experience with, I believe 1995 was the last session that the Joint Trade and Economic Development Committee had its own staff and its own offices, rather than 85.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. Do we have anyone signed up to testify on this bill? Members, I think this is essentially a housekeeping bill that eliminates some obsolete committees that are no longer functioning, and that really is all that it's intended to do. So, we are in a work session. We didn't have anyone to testify. I don't see. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 967A? Seeing no one. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 967A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Buckley has moved Senate Bill 967A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Jim, I just noticed that the bill in my file is only Senate Bill 967, but is there a printed
967?
Yeah. I just must not have it in my file. That's okay.
There's an engross.
I apparently mine hasn't been filed yet.
I believe, Madam Chair, and Jim, correct me if I'm wrong, the only difference is that the original version eliminated references to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee. The amended version leaves the Joint Legislative Audit Committee alone.
I see. Okay.
Madam Chair, please accept that's the information that I have based on the Senate summary.
And what was the vote on this in the Senate?
26-3.
26-3. So. Okay. Great. Well, we have a motion before us, and Vice Chair Brooker, you're out of the room. But I'm sorry. Vice Chair Buckley moved that Senate Bill 967A be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That motion is before us. And yes, Representative Roblin?
You know, I really appreciate the idea of getting rid of statutes that aren't being used, because I think there are too many already. The other issue is, do the LARs that are associated with these, do they go away as well, or does that take action by that department?
I assume that this bill takes care of that. Do you know the answer to that, Mr. Strimbridge?
Madam Chair, that's a technical question. I don't know if you're saying that there
are... I assume that there are. I don't know that there are. But I would... almost every time I write a statute, there are...
From the long list of citations at the beginning of the bill...
I can speak on the Trade and Economic Development Committee. The statute does require reporting on the part of many... agencies to the committee. They may have promulgated administrative rules that address that. I'm not sure on that. In any case, there is a periodic review of administrative rules to determine the relevancy of them. That's the process by which I would think that the administrative rules that go along with these would also be eliminated.
Okay, that sounds fine to me.
Okay, any other discussion?
Yeah, I have a question. I just chatted a little bit about a mutual friend. Maybe you mentioned, how long have these committees been inactive that they would, is it just recent, or is it over a period of a decade, or how long have these committees been inactive that justifies us getting rid of them?
Madam Chair, I have not done the research on each of these. I'd be happy to do that for you and find out. Trade and Economic Development, as I said, 1995, I believe. I don't know about the other ones.
And I've been serving here since 1999. And these are joint committees we're talking about, have not been functioning in the time I've been here.
Okay.
So it's been at least 8-9 years.
Madam Chair, the argument that has been made on these is that if the current speaker and president wish to have a joint committee, they can establish one. And the purpose for, this is my understanding of this now, the purpose for putting them into statute is to attempt to obligate future legislatures. And there isn't much other, and because the Trade and Economic Development Committee, anyway, has been basically ignored, although there have been economic development committees on both sides, and there have on occasion been joint committees. They haven't had the same membership as required by the statute. They haven't had their own staff. They haven't had their own facilities and budgets the way the statute requires. So that's a little bit of background on it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay. Any further discussion? Okay. Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
Madam Chair, would this be an item for the consent calendar?
I would think so, and it passed unanimously. There's been a motion to, I assume that was a motion.
I make a motion to place this on the consent calendar, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Buckley moves that Senate Bill 967A be placed on the consent calendar. Did I just hear somebody say no?
Someone whacked the microphone with all the paperwork,
oh.
I think.
My file.
Is there
I left guilty.
I only recognize your sound because I've done it so many times.
Is there objection? seen none, so ordered. And it will be placed on the consent calendar. I think that may be the first bill we've actually voted out and put on.
And I'm having heartburn over it, Madam Chair, but I'm there.
I know.
You're dragging me.
We'll get you some time.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 967A and open a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 73. Mr. Stembridge.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 73 prohibits paying or receiving money based on the number of signatures a person obtains for the purpose of nominating a candidate for elected office or on the number of signed voter registration cards a person collects.
Okay, thank you for that explanation. We do have a witness signed up to testify on this. Elon Hassan from the Secretary of State's office, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Elon Hassan, Oregon Secretary of State's office. The bill is pretty straightforward, just as Mr. Stembridge explained. It's designed to put some parity in the law. We have Measure 26, which prohibits the payment of people on the basis of the number of signatures they gather on initiative petitions. This just gets nominating petitions within that purview as well as voter registration cards. To be clear, you can still pay people to gather nominating petitions and to gather voter registration cards. This just prohibits the ability to do that on a per-signature basis, and we recommend it pass.
And, Elon, do you have, I know that I remember reading about things that happened in the last couple of election cycles involving voter registrations that were found that had been thrown away, things like that. Is that the sort of thing that this bill is meant to address?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum. You know, yes and no. I mean, there are the general idea here is that if you pay people on the number of cards they are going to collect, they're going to be motivated to produce as many as possible. So I don't know that actually throwing them away would. I think what you're remembering is a lot of there were allegations that parties were either not collecting cards based on the number of particular party registration that people were gathering. This doesn't, it directs the idea that you can't pay on the basis of how many cards you collect. It doesn't actually get into the details of what's on those cards. I think that would be another law. In terms of nominating petitions, though, that certainly was a big issue in 04 in terms of people collecting, being paid by the signature. So okay. I think the answer is no.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions for this witness? Yes, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me. I just noticed that approximately a third of the Senate rejected this idea. I just wondered if you could elaborate on what the objections were.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher. I believe the, I think it was like 21-9 is my guess.
29,
okay. What I heard, one of the arguments was that voter registration is an important part of our system and we shouldn't be doing things to curtail people going out and registering people to vote. It's a valid concern. A couple key things about this. It doesn't prohibit the getting of grants for people who want to do large voter registration drives and organize them and do broad-based voter registration. And again, nor does it prohibit people from getting paid to do voter registration. I think the concern in the Senate was sort of the sanctity of voter registration, which is certainly appreciated. I think we just feel that this doesn't unduly burden that.
Other questions? Yes, Representative Roblin.
More of a comment. You know, I think that when people are pushed to go out and do things by individual cards, it drives bad accounts. So, you know, you get people who are already registered to fill out another card, so you get your dollar for the card that's already filled out, goes to the registrar, they have to figure it out. Oh, we've already got this person already registered. Is there anything different? Is this a change of card? And it may not have anything, so it just causes more work for other people. You have the issue of people who may not even be living in the state. They're just a visitor, and somebody comes up and says, I just need your card. It's not going to cost anything. Fill this out. They send it in, don't have the right address. I mean, I think when you're paid to just go do something, you try to do the right thing when situations are set up to give you the benefit just for getting that card, you get bad cards. And I think this is a good bill, and
right.
We don't want to get into the habit of forcing some people to try to make some money based on the idea that I'm going to just get cards regardless of how accurate they are.
And once again, this doesn't prevent people from being paid.
Right.
Just prevents this bounty system of paying by the...
Yeah.
Okay. Other questions for this witness? Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 73? Members, we are in a work session. Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 73 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Vice Chair Buckley has moved Senate Bill 73 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Anna, please call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries. So Senate Bill 73 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I don't think we want to put this on the consent calendar. It's pretty significant. And
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I would just like to clarify the vote. I have 6-1 that you're voting no. Is that correct?
You're right. It couldn't go on the consent calendar anyway, even if that was a good idea.
And Madam Chair, I just for our listening audience, maybe we ought to make sure that people know what the vote is. So, because I know when you're listening, hear the people called. You can't hear the votes exactly. So, I'll suggest that maybe it's not the time to suggest that. But.
Okay, and I think that the chair will carry this bill. Okay, thank you. And I will close the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 73. And I think that completes the bills that we have before us this morning. So we had previously had a work session, and I will reopen a work session on the proposed change to House Rule 3.20. Members, well, perhaps Mr. Stenbridge would like to fill us in on where we are on this.
Madam Chair, you had the original proposal amendment from Speaker Merkley dated May 1st. You have a change dated May 9th from Representative Rosenbaum, and this morning we have, as submitted by Representatives Buckley, Esquivel, and Roblin, another proposed change. If you'd like to, I can...
Perhaps since we've got three representatives who have worked on this, one of them would like to explain it.
Thank you.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Esquivel and Representative Rubin and I met and also met with the clerk to talk about possibly the hybrid of taking some of the ideas that have been expressed before and trying to put them together in a way that could get broad support. And I think we accomplished putting the hybrid together. It has elements that each one of us likes, including part of the main rule that would require an apology and the member not voting until they apologize or speaking on the House floor. I do need to report to the committee. I did check this with the Speaker's office and had a very entertaining conversation with the Speaker. In short, the Speaker's okay with letting go of the fine idea from his original proposal. However, the apology idea didn't sit well with the Speaker. He gave me several very creative potential apologies that could be offered that would serve to escalate, in his view, the problem rather than deal with it quickly and cleanly, which if I can relay the Speaker's communication to me, his desire was to have something that could be done very quickly, cleanly, that everyone understands what the process is, and then it's over with. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much his desire, at least as expressed to me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there other members who would like to come in on this proposal? Yes, Representative Esquivel.
I think that what we did yesterday, we did some fairly good work here. I would like, I don't know if we can do this. I don't know what the time frame is. I mean, this didn't happen for 150 years, and now we're trying to get it corrected. So I guess what everyone I talk to has a different spin on this.
Yes.
I'd like to float these out to people within and get a general consensus. And this is not a partisan issue. This is a House issue.
each and every one of us are going to have our own opinions, and each and every one of us are going to say yay or nay to one of these. But I would rather have the opportunity to go talk to some of my constituents, because we have not had, or my colleagues, but we have not had an opportunity to really do that. And I would like to have a better feel for what the body thinks on the different proposals, because we have three good proposals, I think.
Representative Esquivel, when we had this up on Wednesday, I did agree, because then I think people weren't ready to vote to carry it over, but I think I was pretty clear that I intended to hold a vote on it today.
I appreciate that, but we didn't receive this until after 5 o'clock last night.
And, yes, Representative Roblin.
I guess from my perspective, and I understand what Representative Esquivel is saying, and I would personally like to see something enacted now so that we have it in rule and people understand, and we prevent something from happening in the future, because I think the whole issue is that we don't have this happen again, and hopefully the rule will do that. So I personally am one of those people who could say your May 9th amendments, which took the $5,000 out, which are embedded in the amendment that we worked on, would be fine with me today to take action on. I mean, the fact is, rules can be changed at different times. And if we decide later that we really do want to put the other part in, we could do that at some other future point. So I have no problem with doing that personally.
Thank you. And Vice Chair Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I, too, have been struggling with this. And the interesting thing is, and this is apropos of Representative Esquivel's comments about wanting to talk to people, I spent a lot, as much time as I could yesterday, trying to talk to people, and they were all as discomforted by the conversation as I am. It was all like, boy, I'm glad I'm not on rules now. and that was sort of the general tenor, and I got as many suggestions as people that I talked to. There's no, I didn't get a sense of consensus. I doubt, in my own way, if more time will make it so. I also am comforted by the fact that this is our rule. If we don't like it, or if there's enough members who come back and say, you guys got it all wrong, this is a better idea, we can change it. We can change it. And future sessions can review this in some way. So I originally liked the main idea of the, you know, public apology and but on further reflection and talking to people, I think that it does open the door to public statements that might not be exactly apologies. And it also punishes the constituents for the behavior of the member. In other words, their voice is silenced on the floor, if that makes sense. And yeah, they can elect somebody else, but it won't be till the next round, and that bothers me. I guess if we go back to the May 9th original proposal, the language in it that says the member may also be subject to other penalties as the House may order allows for something else at the time if the situation warrants, rather than the more prescribed other punishment And believe me, I appreciate the work of the people who got together and said we like this main thing. I'm not discounting it, but in thinking on it, that is allowable if we can come together that there is a specific action that the body wants to take, that the House may order. So I guess in not finding magic things that satisfy me more than the May 8th night, okay? I don't get me wrong. I'm very discomforted by this. And I even floated last round in this committee, oh, well, why don't we do nothing? And that got shot down pretty well. I think that I will support the May 9th proposal, but
thank
just
you.
Uncomfortable.
Thank
all
you,
the way.
Representative Berger, for those comments. Are there other comments from committee members?
Members, I would say I too have had, and I also want to thank the members that worked hard on the alternative proposal. I think that there are a number of ways we could go. Like you, I have had lots of conversations about this, and it's starting to remind me of the story of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, where some people say this is too stiff a penalty. Some people say it's not severe enough. And so I think that, you know, there's no perfect solution to this. But I do feel quite strongly that we need to do something, and I think that we have a proposal that could work. And I now see other members who would like to speak. So, Representative Thatcher, please go ahead.
Yeah, I like the May 9th version better than the original one that I saw, where there was prescribed fines and all that. I'm not comfortable with recording a member's vote as a yay. Though, and that's only done in one other state that I could see looking at this, and I guess that's the part that's most uncomfortable for me. That doesn't seem right, and I think it's, you know, looking amongst the NCSL information that I saw, it's very rare that somebody refuses to vote, it looks like. Mm-hmm. A lot of comments that I've read have indicated that they don't recall that ever happening, or one time it happened and this was the result. I mean, it's just not something that I think will happen a lot. But I am uncomfortable with saying if you're not voting, you're going to be a yes.
And I think clearly our intention is that it be very rare, and that having a consequence may make it less likely that it happens again. And that's why we
hope to address it. What, how long? 150 years? It happened once. It is rare already.
Right.
Even without.
And I'll take you in turn, but Representative Hunt, you were next.
I would agree with Representative Thatcher. I don't particularly like the fact that we recorded either as a yay or nay. But the challenge, I think, unlike in Congress, where if you abstain, that then therefore lowers the bar of what majority it takes to pass a given bill. You know, five people abstain, you don't have to, in Congress, get half of the total number of members, you just have to get a simple majority. Since we have what I think is a fairly unique provision in Oregon, which is not in our rules, so we can't change it because it's in the Constitution, that requires 31 and 16 to pass, I think it just creates a different dynamic where if we allow a member to abstain or allow a member to refuse to vote and don't record it one way or the other, it really, I think, messes up that balance where 31 votes are required. So I agree it would be fairly unique with only one other state, but I think we're fairly unique now by having that 31 and 16 requirement. I do have a question in looking at a question for the South panel as they came up with this. I hope this isn't turning a civil war between the North and the South. I noticed some of the language, setting aside the specific content related to the main provision, some of the way that the proposed rule on the May 11th version is worded, some of the wording is just different in terms of referring to the specific rule. I'm just wondering if that was just a different, if there's some intent and some specific reason why some of the wording is different the way it's actually outlined. Setting aside the substance.
And I see the chief clerk is also in the audience. I know that she helped people draft proposals. So did you, though,
we could speak
like to
that.
Answer
I mean,
this? Sure.
I think that clearly, and we could have the clerk come up too, clearly one of the things that I felt from the speaker was that we really needed to be very intent on letting them know what they were doing wrong so that we are putting on the record in the statement that the speaker gives to the member who has chosen not to vote exactly what they are doing wrong. So there's no doubt that he's been informed that he's breaking a rule, that this is the rule that he broke, and so on. And so it was the idea of making sure that before we censured somebody, that they understood clearly the intent of why they were being censured. Since generally censure takes a vote of the body, this is saying we want it to be as clear as it possibly can be, that they understand that they have broken a rule, which rule it was, what they did, and the consequence of such a thing, before they
answer on their third time they're asked. And so it was just a way of stating that clearly and succinctly so that as a body we knew we weren't doing something arbitrarily. We've exactly explained what they've done wrong. We've exactly expressed them to answer it one more time. They chose not to. That would be the final breach of that rule. And therefore, it makes it easy to, they know what's going to be written in the record for them. They know that their I vote is going to be counted. We had a hard time with the I vote as well in the discussion, but the issue was not voting is a no vote because you still need 31 people, as you were explaining. And so we just wanted it to be clear before you do anything, you are, by taking the action you're taking, you are voting aye. I mean, and so everything is spelled out before they take that last opportunity to vote. That's why we did it.
Thanks for that explanation. We have the chief clerk, so please share your comments with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ramona Kennedy. I'm chief clerk and parliamentarian for the House. And when I met with the, you may call them the South
right.
panel, I call them the gang of three. Actually, they brought me very similar language as you have found in the other two proposals, but I actually had time to sit back and reflect, and so I fine-tuned the language to make sure before we said that they were in violation of House rules, I identified which House rule, that it was only this House rule that this would be applied to. That's why you find the new language on violation of House Rule 320, subsection 1, which says you must vote. And I just clarified more clearly exactly the process by which and the statement that would be made. And clearly we could add those kind of clarifications in either the May 1 or I've got it as the May 8th or May 9th proposal. But again, I would just say that I had more time to sit and actually walk through this one a third time. And obviously when you keep working it, it just keeps getting better for clarification. And then I also took the opportunity last night to forward this down to the editors within Legislative Council to make sure that the form and style was correct, that I had the commas, the semicolons, the, you know, everything was consistent throughout the rule. And they provided that insight to me, and that's what you find before you in the May 11th version.
Thank you, and I think it would be a good idea. I think we're hand-engrossing our copyright to incorporate those changes in whatever version we do adopt. Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a suggestion, if a possible hand-engross of the May 11th version would be after the word yay in Section 2 and in Section 3, crossing out the remainder, the words in the remainder of that section would be keeping the language that the clerk has brought to us, but removing the provision that would not allow a member to speak or vote for violation of the words.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hunt.
I think coupled with what Vice Chair Buckley just said, if we then added that additional last sentence that is in the May 9th version of both Sub 2 and Sub 3, the member may also be subject to other penalties the House
right.
may order.
To the May 11th version?
Right.
Okay.
In both.
Okay. And yes, Representative Esquivel.
Yes, and there's been some talk here about this yay vote since there's not a yay vote, and I struggle with that. But then I thought, you know, if the individual knows going in, then it's the responsibility of the individual, no one else. So, I mean, I was very much against it because it's kind of like the double majority. If you don't vote, it's a no vote. But actually, if you know going in, you're on your own. So,
any more comments on this side? Representative Thatcher?
No.
The North.
The North, yes. I just wonder, looking through some of the provisions spelled out from the different states on the NCSL list that I saw, Some of the states allowed a person to state the reason why they couldn't vote. Would there be still an accommodation to, you know, make a motion to suspend the rules and I move I be abstain, you know, I be allowed to abstain from voting and then state your speak the motion? Is that still a provision?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, anything can be accommodated through a rule suspension.
Okay.
As I mentioned in the meeting the other evening, is that under this provision, it used to state up until the late 90s that with the member could abstain with permission of the body. That had never happened, and so that rule was changed because basically the reason it was put in there, and again, a little history lesson, was in the early 70s when they put in the fact that there was conflicts, potential conflicts, actual conflicts, that if a member felt like the conflict was such that they might want to abstain from voting, they would have to get permission of the body. That had never happened. And so when they did the complete rewrite through the House Management Work Group, I think it was in, submitted in 1999, since it had never been exercised, they took it out. They felt that every member should vote and that they should not be allowed to abstain, even with leave of the body. And so now it raises the bar that if somebody did want to, it would have to be a rule suspension. Anything is appropriate for that purpose. And then they would have to explain why they would want to suspend the rules. Mm-hmm. Hope that answers your question.
Well, I guess I would appreciate having a provision. Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I would appreciate having a provision that a person would be allowed to request and state their reasons for wanting to abstain and having a vote of the body. A lot of the states do that, I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that always, I mean, that could be done with a rule suspension, or it could be done as a remonstrance as well, which our rules, our current rules allow that. I'm sorry.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, I think that, you know, obviously to explain why you refuse to vote would be appropriate under remonstrances. I don't believe that if you refuse to vote that there is an accommodation to explain why you've refused to vote, particularly in this language here. Mm-hmm. I think what I hear Representative Thatcher saying is that ultimately it might be advisable to put in an additional language and reinstate the language that if a member does feel like they would like to abstain, that they be granted that opportunity through a rule suspension prior to the vote being taken, and then it would be up to the members as to whether they would grant that abstention, and it would take then two-thirds of the members to say. That would be a motion that would be taken before we actually took the vote, not unlike when you declare a conflict of interest.
And to clarify, we wouldn't need to change our rules in order to do that, correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Right now, that's a provision that's available. Any rule can be suspended as long as the membership, two-thirds of the membership, 40 members, believe that that is an appropriate suspension. So that clearly is available now. If you wanted to lower that bar of what it would take, then you would have to put something in the rules to define a different level of required vote.
Yes, Representative Roblin.
I thought about this after we had our conversation yesterday, and we were explained that rule was just really changed in 99. And my own belief is that they did the right thing by requiring us to vote, and the reason goes back to our constitutional requirement that we can't change the number of people that it takes to make a majority. It is the elected officials in our Constitution that constitutes how many people are voting. And so an abstention is a no vote, whether they want it to be or not, because we don't make it 58, 59 when that person abstains. And many of the states that do have the provision that allow it, theirs does, like the national bills, that abstention vote means that you have a lower bar to meet the 31 required votes. Our Constitution doesn't allow that, and I think part of that must have been in the discussion that took place when they took the rule out and realized that everybody needs to vote, because our Constitution requires the numbers that are elected, and we have only had a few times in the history of our state when we haven't had a total of 60 elected officials. We in that same discussion, we had the discussion that we had a time here when there was a person who was recalled. Mm-hmm. And during that recall, we did not have 60 elected officials. We only had 59 elected officials. But so there have been times in our history when the Constitution would have allowed us to have a smaller vote, but we are not in that situation right now. And mm-hmm. So and even in the last couple sessions when we've had someone removed and moved over to the Senate,
and we were waiting for a place. There were probably, I would expect, an opportunity at that time to have really looked at whether we really had that many elected officials. I think we probably still did, because even though they were, you can't hold two offices, that position was still elected. I think we'd have to have a discussion about that one. They did actually put a new person in that place fairly quickly, but they didn't wait for the person to be put in. So there was a time when the person was a senator and not. So I think there have been times in our history when we could have had a lesser majority, but it's never been something that we've actually had to deal with. But in a case of an abstention, obviously the person is elected, they're sitting there, so the 31 votes required for a majority would stay the same. So an abstention would be a no vote. And I commend the people in 99 for recognizing that and putting in a rule that says we all have to vote. I know it's hard sometimes for people, because there are times when I'm sure when you're looking at that bill and you're looking at what I'm doing, that it's a true conflict. And if I was on a city council or other places, I would be able to abstain. But in our situation, with the Constitution saying the total bar is 31 every time, it's difficult. But I do also recognize that we do have, within the rules, a way to let people do that, and I think that's enough. So.
Okay. Any further discussion? I want to make it clear that I think we have incorporated the changes that we talked about in both versions, and we can do that because, unlike a bill, this doesn't require legislative council drafting. We are working with the chief clerk to do it. And, members, we are in a work session.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Buckley.
I move the proposed amendment dated, can I ask a question, Madam Chair, before the motion?
Sure.
There was the language, we're merging some language from May 11th and May 9th, and
right.
Our committee administrator has this.
Right.
So, can I
tell you, on the May 9th version, I've hand-engrossed my version so that we are specific in the member's failure to vote constitutes an intentional violation of House Rule 3.20, subsection 1, and we've changed that in both places.
Madam Chair.
And, yes, Vice Chair Berger.
If I could interrupt for a moment. I am discomforted by hand engrossment. I know you want to move this now. Okay? Mm-hmm. Would you entertain the possibility of getting a delaying one more time, mm-hmm. getting an engrossed, fully engrossed version, and getting it, having the rest of the members look at it?
The rest of the members being the members of the committee or the members of the body?
The members of the body.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
My concern with that is, it's hard. It's difficult for this committee to come to an agreement. It's going to be very hard for 60 members to all agree on the language. And in doing this, are we going to give basically veto power to 3 out of the 60 who say, I really hate that?
They have that power now.
Well, they have the power to vote now. But do they have the power to derail the process of putting a rule before the body?
Well, perhaps you could just tell us again what it is you're
here is what we are talking about: the rules of the House. We are a committee of the House, but every member is bound by these rules. And I guess I'm a little discomforted by a hand engrossed, and I tried to talk about this with various members. We all had your original proposal before us when we started this, okay? Many people said, oh, is that what you're talking about? And I had to explain, no, there's this change and there's that change. I would feel much better if the members of the House had what's our hurry here? 150 years. could we not send the engrossed version and allow people to react to it? Yes, some people will not like it. Some people will. The same thing is going to happen if we run it out. But I think it will be seen less as something we are ramming through and more as something that we want the body to consider. I'm sorry, but I just don't think running a hand engrossed out today is is going to be met with anything but why'd you run that out so fast and why didn't I get a chance to look at it?
Well, Mr. Berger, I think the hand in gross thing and we could deal with, because I think if the committee members need to see a final version of this, the chief clerk is indicating that she can do that pretty quickly and get it in front of us. This change that I was talking about is really not a substantive change. All it is making clear what rule is being referred to that the member is violating. And if that's the concern, I think we could probably stand at ease and get a clean copy of this in front of us quite quickly for committee members to look at. It's essentially the same change that we were looking at 2 days ago. So I guess I'm reluctant to then delay it still further. If that's the motion that I sensed was about to be made, I would be happy to stand at ease and have the clerk bring us a clean copy of that. And I think that that's appropriate to have to actually see what we're voting on. I think what I will do at this point, though, is just briefly recess. Or I guess we don't have to recess. We can just stand at ease. So let's stand at ease for a moment. And if the clerk could please go do that, that would be great.
Thank you.
Let's stand at ease. Back to order. And what we have in front of us, thanks to our very efficient chief clerk, is a version dated May 11th, 2007. This actually is a melding of all three of the versions that have been put forward, and so that is what you're looking at. And we are still in a work session, and I will again call on Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, I move the proposed amendment dated May 11th, 2007.
Vice Chair Buckley moves the proposed amendment to House rules dated May 11th, 2007. And yes, Mr. Stemmer.
Madam Chair, I want to clarify that this one says as proposed by the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules.
Yes. Okay. So proposed amendment to House rules as proposed by the Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules dated May 11, 2007. That is before us. Discussion. Yes, Representative Thatcher.
I think we all sufficiently hate it for different reasons. However, because it's not going to be, I really don't think this is going to happen a lot.
Hopefully not.
It can be, hopefully not. But I'll probably support it.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher, for that. Other discussion? Shauna, please call the roll.
Representative Thatcher?
Aye.
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And
Madam Chair, just to clarify, I have a vote of 7-0.
And I have the same vote, 7-0. So the motion carries. And Vice Chair Berger, would you be willing to co-carry this with me on the floor?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, that would be honored. Then Representative Berger and the Chair will co-carry this on the floor. And with nothing further, yes, Representative Roblin.
I just had to state that those of us in the Southern group, we appreciate the language that's so close to what we've done that it was easier for us to vote for this because you took all the hard work we did yesterday. So thank you.
But we noticed the carriers are from the north.
Madam Chair, it leaves us with the ability to blame Esquivel for our habits, too.
Let's just say, y'all did good work.
Yeah. Y'all.
All right, thank you. Not yet. Further to come before us, members, we are adjourned.